Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's episode, a slew of earnings calls. We are in the heart of earnings season, but a lot of positivity in fashion and footwear. We'll also talk very briefly sporting goods retail as Dick's released earnings as well. Our show this week is brought to you by MyEmma.com and Products Up. Very happy to have both of them on board. And we begin today with BJ's Wholesale Club. And for the first time, we have the opportunity to break down their quarterly earnings on the show. About a month ago, we wondered aloud if market optimism surrounding BJ's could sustain with such a high prospective price to earnings ratio as they went public. The answer came this week, and it was a resounding maybe. As the stock initially shed 20% from last Friday, when it hit highs of $29.03, to this Tuesday, August 28th, when the earnings were released, but then shares peaked above $28 once again in trading on Wednesday. It seems as though everyone's still feeling out the company, which is a reasonable stance for a firm that's only been public for a few months. Again, they have 215 locations, primarily on the East Coast. And Leighton, after the call, we saw all kinds of headlines. We saw one from the Motley Fool that said the sad truth about BJ's Wholesale. Some people said BJ's Wholesale not joining the club. Some people said BJ's shined in their earnings call.
BJ's Wholesale to me is a company that I've kept an eye on. I personally have been affiliated with Sam's Club in the past. I have obviously covered Costco earnings calls, and I am a fan of wholesale clubs in general. BJ's Wholesale Club, this is a company that we were excited to cover once they became public. Again, they were public back before 2011. They were taken private for a little bit, but now we were able to see into their performance. And as a company, Trent, they are no Costco. They are no modern Sam's Club. And a lot of people were wondering, are they going to be using the cash from the IPO? Obviously, they have more capital now to do more than to just pay down debt. Are they going to position themselves in a little bit better of a spot? Are they going to extend beyond just the few states that they're currently in? And we didn't really have a lot of clear answers from their very first earnings call since they became public yet again here now in 2018. We do see, though, some positives from BJ's, and that Sam's Club sales, excluding gasoline, came in at a positive 2%. Showing the impacts of gasoline prices, however, so with gasoline included, same-store sales were up a whopping 5%. So very good numbers for them. Again, no Costco, no Sam's Club, which has been coming in with 3 to 4% comps consistently for the last couple of years now. Luckily for BJ's, however, Wall Street, including those gas comps for this quarter, their expectation was around 1.3%. So including gas comps, they still beat no matter what. So if you're looking at the comps with or without gas, BJ's fared fairly well. Their overall sales did increase by 4.3% to $3.2 billion. This was helped mightily, again, by those low-margin gasoline sales. Even with those fuel sales, Trent, they missed the analyst mark by $30 million. This proved to be their only real miss, however, as they ended up beating on earnings per share. And on that earnings per share front, something investors haven't been able to discuss post-BJ's earnings call since, again, 2011, they came in at a loss of 5 cents per share. Adjusted, however, they did show positive earnings at 31 cents per share, and they were very bullish on their adjusted EBITDA of $143 million, which was said by management, at least, to be a record for the company. With membership dues, it's always worthwhile to talk about their memberships. Their membership fee actually increased 9.7%, or at least their membership fee income increased 9.7% to just under $71 million, marking a sizable increase for the warehouse club. While this sounds like membership itself might have been up, let us recall back in January of this year where BJ's actually raised their membership prices roughly 10% from $50 to $55. So we're seeing the impacts from the increase in the 9.7% growth number, certainly. Although not all members have renewed for their 12-month period at that price. By the way, by the by, if you enter in BJ's Wholesale Club, you will see a lot of promotional givings by the company. some of their newer promotional strategy is to have just 3-month memberships or highly discounted memberships. Some memberships, 12-month memberships, are seen as low as $25. And by the way, they have partnered with Groupon in the past, so that certainly will cut into their bottom line. And by the way, Sam's Club does the same thing, so we have to count that into the equation as well. They're just doing what their competitor does. Sam's Club has done a number of Groupon promotions depending on what market you're in. They did mention, BJ's did mention an expectation of renewals to decrease by 1% to 1.5% as a result of the recent hike. However, you do have to factor in those one-time promotional memberships that are coming up for the company. I'm curious to see if those people that are on those short-term memberships decide to renew after all.
And overall, Christopher J. Baldwin, who is the CEO of BJ's Wholesale, said on the call that they were pretty pleased with the second quarter overall. He mentioned their ability to attract and retain members. Once again, speaking to those membership fees coming in, getting more members ideally in the future coming in. And he mentioned convenience as well, trying to make it convenient to shop at BJ's. But the overarching issue with earnings calls like this, and there were plenty of analysts on this earnings call as this was much anticipated in the retail world, because this is their first public call in a while, the company provides us comparables, but it's still difficult to evaluate where the company is at on certain initiatives. When you follow a company for several years, you begin to know and trust in how that company is progressing with certain initiatives after having been a private company for so long. Even with their initial documents, financial documents released, there are still smaller store initiatives that are tough to put a finger on the pulse of. Additionally, many of the traditional numbers we track, such as SG&A or selling, general and administrative expenses, were knocked askew by the timing of their IPO in this last quarter. So it's kind of difficult to tell because overall, they showed a non-adjusted loss because of the IPO, and SG&A expenses were way out of whack with what they typically are. Many more administrative fees as they were trying to iron out their IPO details with banks and the SEC. But a couple of takeaways here, and I think we've already covered and underscored the fact that a lot of people don't know what to expect from BJ's, whether to expect stellar quarters or whether to be a little bit bearish on the Warehouse Club. But they did, at the end of the day, increase their forecast for adjusted earnings per share up to a range of $1.17 to $1.24. Now, this is interesting because it still lags behind Wall Street consensus estimates of $1.28. When we say consensus, though, there really is no consensus about BJ's because there's this enormous range of Wall Street expectations with this newly public company, anywhere from 85 cents per share at the end of the year to $1.61 per share at the end of the year for adjusted earnings per share. That is a massive range, a far greater range than we see with most retail companies. And that's maybe why the stock didn't pop so much after a fairly progressive earnings call where the company did adjust positively their forecast going forward. Every now and again, we hear from some retailers wanting to keep track of all of their marketing import and export channels. You know, people say they're losing their head every time they want to advertise on Amazon, Facebook, or get a big e-commerce or Shopify product data group. They claim that a lot of this stuff is a mess and they wish there was a way to easily and efficiently manage product data inventory and get products accepted and published by all the channels out there.
Imagine if you were able to integrate a large variety of data sources from the most popular shop systems to PIM software and third-party data suppliers. Maybe you would stop losing market share by selling more products to relevant customers.
All of this is possible, believe it or not. Products Up ultimately helps you to create a consistent and compelling product experience across all your digital touch points. That's Products Up, all one word. You can check out their booth at shop.org. You know, shop.org is right around the corner in Las Vegas on September 12th. If you're not thinking about going yet, you probably should be. It's a fantastic conference. We went in LA last year, had a great time. Book your meeting at shop.org. on go.productsup.io/shop.org. Again, that's go.productsup.io/shop.org. We'll put that URL in the description of today's episode so you can link right to this website and book your meeting for shop.org with Products Up today. We move on in the show to Tilly's. And Tilly's is a largely U.S. Southwest shoe and clothing chain, although they are in several states throughout the U.S. They reported earnings on Wednesday amidst a backdrop of adjusting their e-commerce initiatives. First, a little bit of background on Tilly's. This is the first time we've discussed the retailer on the Retail Focus podcast. Last quarter, Tilly's actually saw the rare combination of shrinking e-commerce sales with increasing physical store sales. Now, not all retailers have seen shrinking physical store sales, but just about everyone has seen increasing e-commerce sales in this climate, and certainly most of the businesses that we've covered on the podcast. But in their last quarter, e-commerce, in fact, was down 7.2% over the prior year's quarter. By that, I mean e-commerce sales. But their same-store sales were up in physical locations by 1.2%. Now, this is a bit of an outlier for the retailer, as they were in the midst of readjusting their e-commerce efforts, and they kind of saw a big overhaul with their e-commerce system at the beginning of this calendar year that caused a massive disruption to service availabilities and levels, thus some of those negative comps. The positive for the company, though, is the fact that same-store sales in physical locations were up because their brand has become increasingly popularized among teens and early 20-somethings, particularly in their target markets of Arizona, Nevada, and California, and that caused the physical sales, therefore, to rise, even when they weren't seeing those rises on the e-commerce platform. But management said on their first quarter earnings call that they started to see things turn around in the beginning of the second quarter. Keep that in mind. Blayton will talk about that here in a second. But they do hope to have more omnichannel capabilities with their new e-commerce system. Now, in the meantime, they've been building out what they call their RSQ pop-up store concepts in existing markets. Unlike their 223 regular brick-and-mortar stores, the three pop-up stores they currently have a bit of a more temporary look, and they actually noted in their previous earnings call that there was significant interest from landlords regarding the pop-ups at ICSC earlier this year in Las Vegas. And for those that don't know, ICSC is a massive retail real estate conference, the biggest really in the United States, or in my opinion, the biggest in the United States. One other note before I turn it over to Layton for the results for Tilly's. This quarter's comps were bound to come in ahead of last year as some back-to-school sales moved into the second quarter this year. They were in the third quarter last year entirely, but a few days of back-to-school sales got shoved into the second quarter this year, and the company mentioned that might positively affect earnings before the call, and they're also fairly realistic that it'll probably negatively affect third quarter results in 3 months. But that's not what we're worried about, at least for the time being. What we're worried about is the results this week that came after market close on Wednesday.
Those e-commerce problems, you might ask, they seem to be a thing of the past, as e-commerce net sales ended up rising over 8% over the second quarter from a year ago. And that wasn't all, as their comps in physical stores once again rose, this time by 3.8%. This is on top of comps that rose 2.1% in the second quarter of last year. Between the two, so if you're stacking the two comparable comps, you see that overall comps were up 4.4%. Gross profit spiked sharply as well, up to $50.1 million from around $40 million a year ago. Part of this was a result of increased top-line revenue, and part of it was because of increased margins. Gross margins went up from 29.5% to around 31.8%. Pretty good increase for this smaller company. SG&A as a percentage of sales was also down sharply due to somewhat of a resolution of a legal matter in this last year's second quarter. When adjusted, it was still down as a percentage of net sales. And that brings us to net income, which came in at 29 cents per diluted share on an adjusted basis versus 11 cents last year. So you might ask, and we should address it on this podcast, why is everything seemingly trending up? Well, of course, it's due to the movement of a few days of those back-to-school sales being in the second quarter, as Trent talked about, them being only in the third quarter last year. However, the increases in the second quarter over last year go beyond just a few days of that back-to-school sales benefit. Some of the surge is likely due to their slight adjustment of stores and markets as well. In 2017, they closed more stores than they opened. So far in 2018, they've turned it around and opened 8 stores to just one closure, a pretty decent growth rate for a company with just 226 total stores. And that includes, of course, those 3 pop-up locations that Trent mentioned. They expect to open 7 new stores for the final 2 fiscal quarters of 2018, their highest number of openings since 2015, and reflective of a near 8% jump over last year. In terms of assistance in the e-commerce and omnichannel areas, they ended up relaunching their direct-to-consumer program to all stores late in the second quarter. Something they hinted at during previous earnings calls is having a bit more difficult implementation, their pickup in-store program, still being tested in a few markets under the new e-commerce system.
Now, as far as product categories for Tilly's were concerned, all departments had positive comps with the exception of one. That was boys. And the boys' product category, for reference, was down less than 1%. So positivity across the board. Footwear in particular had strong comps. And we'll get to a few other footwear retailers later in the show that saw the same thing in their most recent quarters. Footwear plays largely into what Tilly's does as a retailer. Now, there is one note to watch regarding Tilly's going forward. They did mention the resolution of that legal matter we discussed in the earnings call. Well, that could impact their third quarter, perhaps positively, but more than likely negatively, at least in terms of margins, because as part of the settlement terms, they're going to be sending out a one-time 50% discount on a single future transaction up to $1,000 to 612,000 existing Tilly's customers. That's right, 50% off, not just a single item, a single future transaction up to $1,000 to over 600,000 customers. Of course, this is almost certainly going to negatively impact margins, but it may also positively influence store traffic for what it's worth for the third quarter and beyond. And it also might help redrive some traffic to their revamped e-commerce site. Now, the company is straightforward in saying they don't really know how the discounts will impact financial figures going forward in the third quarter or quarters beyond. And it bears mentioning the coupons expire 1 year from issue, so people will have approximately 12 months to use those coupons if they so choose. However, it is something to watch for on future earnings calls. And because of that, despite this great earnings call, the future a little bit murky, at least in terms of the bottom line for Tilly's over the next 3 quarters, maybe 4 quarters. Now, Tilly's stock did tick up in the days leading to their call as a result of strength in fashion during Tuesday's earnings calls in particular. And again, we'll talk to a few of those in a second. But shares went from $17 last Friday, slowly increased on Tuesday, and then were up to $18 at close on Wednesday. After the earnings call, in aftermarket trading, shares shot up above $19. Again, that was Wednesday, August 19th. At that point, a price-to-earnings ratio of around 34 for this suddenly resurgent and upstart retailer who had struggled so much on the e-commerce front just a few quarters ago. They seem to have things turned around heading into the second half of fiscal year 2018.
Well, we move on with a fairly short story in Dick's Sporting Goods, and they were not the beneficiary of a strong retail environment that we've been seeing from all the other retailers we've been reporting on. Shares fell double digits as they were unable to push several key apparel categories. Still, the retailer was more profitable than some of their competitors. A lot of retail analysts last week were talking about other sporting goods companies like Hibbett Sports missing the mark overall and seeing sort of a muddled future. Their earnings per share, however, Dick's Sporting Goods, those expectations were beaten handedly, coming in around $1.20 per share, several percent higher than analyst expectations. The top line revenue missed by about $50 million brought forth by a stale Under Armour inventory. Management blamed Under Armour's decision to distribute a little more widely their products. And overall, that is a problem. Under Armour's sort of getting thin there because they have a distribution partnership with Kohl's, as well as several other e-commerce players, therefore sort of tapering demand on the Dick's branded locations. Why still so profitable, though, if they notably missed revenue? You have to look at the details here, and management said that a better, more refined product assortment was good for the company, and that their private label brands have been strong as of late. Private label brands, if you remember some of our earnings calls recently with Dick's Sporting Goods, especially the fourth quarter, their main focal point in recent earnings calls has been to have more private label brands. However, this has been at the expense of some of their longer-term vendors. A lot of those vendors not pleased with them having their products pushed out of Dick's Sporting Goods stores. But Dick's Sporting Goods, looking at those margins, looking at the demand for some of those trendier products, they think it's going to be beneficial for them, at least in the short to midterm, to carry more private label products. They keep talking about how many more products for those private label brands they're bringing in to each individual store. Additionally, the company said they are going to be purposefully having less sales, so less promotions to bring customers in. And this doesn't appear, at least in the short term, to be hurting store traffic too terribly much. Therefore, they are able to sell more items at a fuller price. And it also doesn't hurt that customer confidence or consumer confidence is at a relative high per the U.S. Conference Board, which recently just came out with a study which said that consumer confidence for the month of August, this August, is at an 18-year high. So a lot of positives that are in the favor of all retailers, not just Dick's Sporting Goods.
CEO Edward Stack on the call was actually pretty excited to see yet another double-digit gain in e-commerce sales. And I want to talk about a couple of those e-commerce initiatives here in a second. They've been more and more bullish on e-commerce sales since taking over much of the sporting goods market share in the U.S. due to bankruptcies and buyouts. Management is confident generally that sales in all channels should increase as they push through the rest of 2018, noting that they do expect any current headwinds to subside, and that was seen in their rise of full-year earnings per share expectations, now expected to be between $3.02 and $3.20 per share, up from its previous range between $2.92 and $3.12 per share. Analysts still expecting around $3.09 per share for the full year. Now, as Leighton mentioned, stock fell downward quite a bit. They've pretty much rebounded to the levels prior to earnings. As of Wednesday's close, shares are in the upper $35 range. We should remember that shares started off 2018 at $29. All-time highs at the end of 2016, though, were around $61. So, losing nearly half of their market capitalization within the span of just a year. Price-to-earnings ratio still sitting at 11.5. Now that we've talked about the stock, I want to talk about some of these initiatives that Dick's was talking about on this earnings call. Leighton, of course, mentioned the strength in the private label brands, but one thing that I found interesting regarding e-commerce is the test of lockers in their stores. They're buy online, pick up in store lockers. If you buy a product online, agree to pick it up in a store, you get a code to a locker. You can go into the store, go up to the locker, use the code, get your merchandise, and walk out. There's no waiting on an employee generally, and it helps throughput at the front of the store, which has been a bit of an issue for Dick's at points in time in the past. And Leighton, I tried out a couple of these lockers from a few different companies that were offering buy online pickup in store solutions back at the National Retail Federation's big show in New York earlier this year. And I've got to say, it was a very smooth experience, and I think you're going to see a lot more retailers turning to this, but it's unique to Dick's because, of course, you've got a lot of athletes using it. Athletes are, of course, used to using lockers in theory, and they said they've actually tested out very well with athletes in particular buying things online and picking up sports equipment in stores. And in fact, initial results were so encouraging at their three test stores that they expanded the test to 10 in total. And they were actually really surprised at how much this improved their satisfaction score in online transactions, particularly for athletes. And they're also testing curbside pickup in select stores as well. Just something to keep an eye on going forward for Dick's. I think that's probably certainly the way of the future for buy online pickup in store for Dick's locations. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to see those lockers or those type of lockers rolled out to most locations within a year or 2 years. One of the other things to keep an eye on with Dick's is their in-store experience. Now, Leighton, you and I both remember a time when Dick's was as much almost a Cabela's or Bass Pro Shops. You could go and test out golf clubs. They had all these experiential aspects built into the store. Well, they're starting to bring some of that back. They're adding hit tracks, batting cages in their baseball area in certain locations. They're including what they call an elevated outerwear in their license shop department section. And they're actually taking some of the hunting products out of 10 Dick's stores where that category hasn't been performing all that well so that they have room for some of these experiential aspects. So it's interesting how Dick's has kind of come full circle. They took out a lot of the driving ranges in some of their stores throughout the U.S., and now they're kind of returning to that experiential aspect. They want to make Dick's certainly a destination where you can try before you buy. And that's really what's missing from a lot of online sporting goods retailers. Leighton, I know you and I both buy sporting goods online. It is very tough to get decent sporting goods online that fit and that work well. Until you've tried something and fully tried it out, it's very difficult to drop $300 or $400 or whatever it might be on a piece of sporting good, on a piece of sporting equipment. So in this circumstance, it seems like Dick's trying to differentiate themselves with their brick and mortar concept against all of these e-commerce players that you have there in the sporting goods realm. And one thing that I should note, Amazon still has yet to really kind of pop their head above the surface when it comes to sporting goods. Their sporting goods selection still fairly slim, even from third-party vendors. So I think this is something that Dick's, if they operate quickly enough, they might see more positivity, more of those double-digit increases that Edward Stacks so liked this last quarter in future quarters. Now, here's some advice for anyone that sends emails to their customers. And I understand that's probably a lot of you out there that own or operate retail stores or service-related stores. Look, you deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch.
With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team with no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on every day to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more.
So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today. All you have to do is go to myemma.com. Again, that's myemma, E-M-M-A.com. Well, in our final news block in this week's Retail Focus podcast, it was a good time to be a shoe retailer if you were publicly traded on Wall Street this week. And we start with DSW. We'll talk about Shoe Carnival here in a bit. But DSW's stock popped over 20% in trading Tuesday after, you guessed it, beating on earnings. It seems like a constant theme in the retail world, beating on earnings this summer. And in fact, for DSW, the stock rose all the way near $33 per share, a price not seen for the company since July of 2015. At the beginning of this year, the stock price was around 20. Bit of a background, DSW Incorporated, which includes not only the 515 designer shoe warehouse stores in the U.S., but also 289 leased shoe departments and other retailers in the U.S., showed signs of a surge as early as the early parts of this year. In fact, their first quarter, going back a quarter, saw a sales bump up more than 7% and same-store sales rise a respectable 2% year over year. Now, the turnaround, if you can call it that, is really, they only saw a brief period of struggles over the last couple of years, seemed to be put into motion last year as their same-store sales declined just 0.4% in the entirety of fiscal year 2017 versus a decline of 3.0% in fiscal year 2016. One other housekeeping note regarding those lease departments. I mentioned the 289 lease shoe departments. They actually exited Gordman's earlier this year. A handful of Gordman stores had lease shoe departments through DSW. Stein Mart locations, however, have management excited going forward. Interestingly enough, both Gordman's and Stein Mart have seen their fair share of troubles. Gordman's still trying to manage a massive debt load, but slowly expanding, and we've talked in the past on the show, how they're slowly expanding to mid-size retail markets that may not have an off-price retailer. Anyway, that aside, Leighton, there have been some crucial recent moves for the company ahead of this earnings call.
Those crucial recent moves for the company include their move to exit e-buys. After a thorough analysis in late 2017, a chain-wide rollout of DSW Kids, executed this spring, as a matter of fact, and the launch of the new DSW VIP loyalty program back in May. All of those things assisted in the second quarter earnings beat, with DSW slaughtering even the most bullish of expectations. And Trent, this is interesting because we're talking about mostly positive news over the past 3 weeks with a variety of different retailers in a variety of different earnings calls. And it's so funny to think back just 10 months ago when everyone was saying retail is dead Amazon is taking over. Well, fast forward to right now, 91% of sales still occur in brick and mortar businesses. And DSW, as you previously mentioned, Trent, a massive presence in brick and mortar. So retail is dead. That is not correct. You should look at all of those analysts who said those words and then counter it with the facts, those objective numbers that have been coming in week after week after week. And DSW, they are taking their part, taking their fair share of the shoe market share. And when we say slaughtering, Trent, we mean it. As the company saw their comp sales grow a massive 9.7%, this is Ulta Beauty category, if you want to really get into the numbers here. And overall revenue growth of 16.4%, extremely impressive for a retailer that some could say is potentially overpaying for some of their leases in their new locations, to $795 million in revenue this quarter, a massive beat for the company. You look at those GAAP earnings, those weren't actually too great looking on the outside at a loss of 48 cents per diluted share. However, the loss was entirely attributable to their Canada retail segment, which was initiated in 2014 as part of a two-step process. So after paying the Piper for the acquisition there in terms of a goodwill impairment charge of around $36.2 million, adjusted earnings per share came in at a positive 63 cents versus last year, Trent, because it's all about contrasting versus last year's results. They came in around half as much last year. Other key figures for the company include cash and cash equivalents increasing to $289 million for the company from $271 million a year ago, and inventories per square foot increasing 12%, 2% on a two-year stack basis, to attempt to stay in lockstep with the increased demand there for their product. In contrast, inventory is one thing Shoe Carnival, the company we will be talking about in our next story, is actually looking to minimize, as their inventory levels actually went down 2% in their latest quarter. But Trent, going through some of the call details with DSW, for all the positives, SG&A was up 23% in the second quarter, driven half by the Canadian acquisition and half by increased advertising costs. On the other side of things, all major categories had comps come in positive for the quarter, really ensuring the shareholders that their strategy that they've outlined in previous quarters is staying put.
And all this talk about aggression on every earnings call over the past year, we really see that, not only with the increase in SG&A expenses, now, as you mentioned, partially the Canadian acquisition to blame for that, but the increased advertising costs there, the bump up in inventory, all of this screams aggression. And management actually on the call particularly credited the inventory increase for assisting seasonal, leisure, and kids. Now, those three areas generated a whopping 85% of their sales increase versus last year. That's right. Seasonal, leisure, and kids accounted for 85% of the already pretty large DSW sales increase versus the same quarter last year. And certainly part of the inventory increase overall was focused towards the nationwide rollout of DSW Kids. But CEO Roger Rawlins applauded their program of what he called distorting inventory investments towards those three categories, again, seasonal, leisure, and kids, in order to generate more sales. So this is a circumstance where, as Leighton mentioned, not all retailers want to do it, but in this case, DSW thought that if they were more aggressive in terms of hawking around inventory, they would be able to move that product, and move that product they have. On a side note, DSW has a very keen eye for metrics. One of the things we like about being on their calls is that they tend to be more transparent than not with them. They break down categories, but also how those individual categories affect sales growth overall. And DSW, you know, it's funny, sometimes you're on a call with a retailer and they either don't track that metric or they don't make it public. Very seldom do analysts ever stump a DSW executive on a call, because they have a metric for everything and they follow everything. And in this day and age, it's still pretty weird to hear retailers say, oh, either we don't track it or we don't break it down that way. But anyway, that's a soapbox type item. Another thing DSW mentioned, again, general aggression, not just expansion, but in attempting to grab market share and share of mind in a time of perceived flux for the shoe retail sector. And I say perceived because this week proved that it's anything but in flux. Many point to the issues at Payless as a prime example. You see all these clickbait headlines that say, you know, Payless is closing all of these stores. With this week's calls, it seems to be more of an issue with mismanagement and location negativity with Payless than anything. The aggression, at least for DSW, has played out in that increasing advertising spend. digital marketing was actually a regular theme on the call and a big reason why advertising spend was up. They also mentioned a new employee alignment program that separates their warehouse employees or back of store employees and their sales staff. They claim that this should hopefully actually produce some payroll efficiencies while also clarifying staff roles with the idea of providing better customer service, but it's a little too early for management to tell specific impacts here. Now, for retail geeks like us, perhaps the most notable thing to watch may be their brand differentiation. And what I mean by that is the way in which they're leveraging their physical locations to reach out to customers and provide that differentiation of experience over other shoe stores. First, they've started a new service offshoot called W Nail Bar. The first of these is in Columbus, and they say it is performing well. So well, in fact, that they're opening their second Columbus location in a few weeks with W Nail Bar. And they have five more locations they're eyeing throughout the U.S. outside of Columbus. Secondly, they've begun to test shoe and handbag repair in-store, also in the Columbus market. This, too, has performed so well that the services are expected to be extended to the New York metro area in the next couple of months. So if you're in the New York metro, watch for those to hit DSW stores. Truly, these initiatives may be able to serve as massive differentiators for DSW based on service. These are generally not things we see from similar stores in their category. You don't see a lot of discount shoe retailers offering these type of services, and DSW is hoping that this can put them and set them apart for the rest in much the same way as Ulta's service initiatives have set them apart from the rest of the other companies in their category.
As you look forward with the company, DSW, now in their Canadian division, and now that you see that it is fully integrated into their balance sheet, they gave investors a look forward at how they plan on managing the group. The Canadian group includes Shoe Company, Shoe Warehouse, DSW, and Town Shoes for a total of 178 stores. So you have to ask, how are they going to manage? Are they going to be rebranding some of these stores? What are they going to do? Well, one of the first things they noted is their attempt to exit entirely the Town Shoes banner, which is largely mall-based and a more full-price store than the other banners. They want to exit actually 38 Town Shoe locations by the end of this fiscal year. On the flip side, however, they do see room for a fleet of around 40 to 50 DSW Canada locations eventually. So long-term, that is their goal. They have around 27 currently in Canada. They feel as though the Canadian division will add value to their full-year earnings per share, bring in around $215 million by year's end. They also boosted their revenue outlook, partially because Canada and partially because of same-store sales, from a decrease of 1% to 3% to an increase now of 6% to 9%. This, along with their adjusted earnings per share revision, was likely to be the main factor in the share prices soaring this week. They now see adjusted earnings per share from $1.60 to $1.75 per share, an 8-cent increase on both ends of the range. So 8-cent increase on the bottom end, 8-cent increase on the top end. And of course, they now see comps coming in mid-single digits, although they are still clinging to the low to mid as a way of sandbagging potential outcomes, whereas before, expectations for the full year were in the low single digits.
While not as impressive, Shoe Carnival also reported Tuesday and also reported an earnings beat. As a result of DSW's report and other strong retail offerings, their stock popped over 5% in trading before their earnings release came out on Tuesday afternoon after market close. That's on top of a bullish month of May and being up over 140% since this time last year. The stock has seen its fair share of volatility, but for the most part has enjoyed most of their second quarter earnings showing, resulted in 76 cents per share, beating the estimates calling for 57 cents. While beating expectations by such a hefty margin, that's rather commendable. For us, it's the fact that they nearly tripled their EPS performance during the second quarter earnings release in 2017, where they showcased 24 cents per share. So looking at year over year, this is a massive increase. Also, the second quarter in a row, by the way, for fiscal 2018, that they beat consensus expectations by double digits in terms of percentage points. Now, revenue of $268 million did not surpass expectations by such an impressive margin, but it did by around 1% nonetheless. It did come in also $33 million greater than last year. So basically what this is saying, to summarize, they didn't make quite as much to beat by such a large margin over analyst expectations, but the bottom line is they're pocketing more of that money going forward.
And they're reining in a lot of those expenses, Trent. And I think that's why you see operating income was up 130%, and gross margins did see a slight improvement as well. So a lot more cash to play with as they look to expand going forward. The negative here, they have $10 million less in cash on the balance sheet to play with. So as you go through the notes here from the earnings call, you can see that the company is going kind of back and forth on what they want for the company. CEO Cliff Sifford announced that Mark Warden will be taking over as Executive Vice President of Marketing and Strategy. And in Sifford's eyes, Warden's role will be to further elevate the brand that they've put so much time into to this point. He hinted at how times are changing advertising-wise, and we know this is certainly the case in modern advertising because a lot of companies end up advertising on social media, trying to relay how they have the best trends out there for shoes, how they have the elevated brands. They need these brands quickly and efficiently to their stores so that customers can try to take advantage. And they're really targeting younger generations, generations that have never even stepped foot in a shoe carnival location. So I think this is extremely important to bring in this experience. And speaking of experience, Mark Warden brings in 23 years of it in branding and marketing experience from SC Johnson Company and Kimberly-Clark Corporation primarily. Leadership sees Shoe Carnival as being a more reliable shoe steward going forward, if you will, providing customers with that consistency in those well brands like Nike and acquiring new customers as they identify new trends with those elevated brands. Again, it's going to all be about leadership strategy here if they're trying to stay on par with their competitors that, like we said, have been posting consistent same-store sales gains. They labeled their relationship with customers as being a special one because of this reliability, this known brand, if you will. Speaking of the consumer, warmer than expected weather propelled sales of women's non-athletic shoes. We do have to note that if we saw sales in the negative territory, no doubt would we have seen the blame placed on weather all the same. I think it's going to be the case that a strong consumer sentiment and a strong buying environment has helped all of these companies alike. The seasonal sales helped to boost gross margins as they were able to take advantage of some of the demand out there. Back to school season was widely seen as a success for Shoe Carnival, something we noted last week with Kohl's, in fact, and during a previous story on this podcast. Back to school, by the way, something that they are still promoting on their website. If you go to shoecarnival.com, the very first page says, "Jump back to school." They have a massive campaign with kids with new shoes on. Shows kids happy to show off their new sneakers. Men's sandals and new trendier men's shoes also did very well. They mentioned that people are liking the bolder colors. And to be honest, Trent, who doesn't besides us where we just wear plain old shoes?
Yeah, I'm more of an earth tones guy myself. But anyway, this and other factors helped to increase transaction volume, which led to stellar same-store sales. We haven't mentioned those yet. Comps were up 6.7%. Not quite DSW territory, but still very, very strong, carrying momentum from that stronger half of the first quarter. A reminder here, in this retail climate, 2 to 3% comps, pretty good. Anything above that gets into the really good stage. The start of quarter three is said to be even better. They mentioned on the call, overall comps are already seeing this 7% range over last year. Now, we have to explore the fact that it was not all the best news for Shoe Carnival, as traffic is down low single digits, but customers are spending more and they are buying more shoes per transaction. Still, the problem may be in their marketing. It's obvious that the customers that do come into the store end up enjoying the experience more on average than in the past because of that dollar spend. Yet perhaps the general public hasn't been made aware, or maybe those advertising campaigns, Leighton mentioned the jump back to school campaigns, just aren't enough to push people into the store. And actually, funnily enough, management has most likely realized this, and hence the new marketing executive in charge. Now, on our last podcast, we discussed how real estate moves have really helped Tuesday morning. With Tuesday morning, their approach was three-pronged with closures, relocation to better areas, and aggressive lease negotiation for all of the stores that are seeing a nearing expiration date. You might ask what this has to do with Shoe Carnival. Well, Shoe Carnival has largely decided to not close many of the stores that they originally thought they would have to, according to management on the call. Instead, they're focusing on the individual stores and how there might be smaller factors contributing to their struggles. Inventory as a whole, so for all stores, was down at 2%. You contrast that with the inventory bump at DSW. Also, Shoe Carnival is being very, very active in landlord negotiation, which is said to have helped them. And Leighton, I know this is something that interested you about the call.
Anytime you include retail and real estate, my ears are going to perk up. And anytime you talk about landlord negotiation, making deals happen, staying in a particular retail complex because you're able to hash out a better deal, that's always going to benefit the retailer. And now for 2018, total projected store closures for Shoe Carnival range from 15 to 17. So they plan on closing 15 to 17 total stores for 2018. However, go back just 6 months ago, they had projected a range between 20 and 25. So those landlord negotiations that Trent was talking about, they're working. They're working very, very well. And they're identifying those stores that are underperforming just a little bit and saying, you know what? Is there anything we can do as far as localizing these stores? They do a four-wall analysis saying, what can we better do? How can we better merchandise these stores to make it a little bit better? And guess what? If you pay a lower lease expense every month, that also adds to that bottom line, that pressure that they're looking at. Doing that analysis, it definitely helps them in the end. So far, just 6 net closings through 2 quarters for the company. But in the quarter 3, they're opening 3 stores and closing just 3. So it's going to have a neutral effect for the company. At quarter's end, they have 402 stores in 35 states, a reasonable number, sure. So if you're looking at the stock and saying, well, where do they go from here? Because they're on a decent run. Do they have a lot of room to grow? And that's one thing shareholders are going to be looking at and should be really keeping a closer eye on with respect to possible future growth. But especially considering the sheer amount of territories they don't currently operate in, we think there is an opportunity for them to open in a few more states, a few more markets, if you will, because if you look at their current presence, and by the way, you can look at all of their stores on shoecarnival.com, they could be in a lot better metropolitan areas in states where they already reside. So if you talk about distribution and how that's going to be expensive, they can't necessarily blame those expenses on expanding in a state where they already exist, not far from another store. Shares of Shoe Carnival, ticker SCVL, reached all-time highs this week, nearing $38 a share. Started off this year, just back in January, at $27 a share. Market cap has grown to roughly $600 million now, or in other words, $1.4 million per store. That is, if you don't take out those e-commerce sales. Price-to-earnings ratio of 20 times, which is actually pretty hefty. I think the average company that we've been looking at right in this realm is around 16 to 17 times. Not bad for a company Shoe Carnival size. Again, it is all about what you think they are going to do in the future, how they're going to execute on their strategy. Are they going to bring up those underperforming stores? Are they going to continue winning through those lease negotiations? A lot of important things, a lot of important hurdles to address in the coming quarters.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We finally reached the conclusion of the Retail Focus podcast with our last segment, the segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I pick out a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week or month, and we begin with Leighton.
We talked in a recent earnings call regarding Big Lots about how the CEO was still absent due to medical issues back in December. Well, that CEO, David Campisi, ended up retiring in April, and we did not cover that on the podcast. Our apologies. Campisi was on surprise medical leave after an earnings call in December. If you remember, we did cover that particular earnings call, and the surrounding executives had done very well at taking over the day-to-day operations. In fact, not only did they take over the day-to-day operations, they followed through with his desires, his strategy that he had previously implemented. But now the company has to move forward, and they did so in a big way as they've recently named Bruce K. Thorne, 51 years of age, as president and CEO. He has not yet taken the reins of the company because guess what? He is still working for Tailored Brands. He's actually the chief operating officer of Tailored Brands, who obviously operates Men's Warehouse, Joseph A. Bank. However, the transition is underway, and he's actually expected to come in to the corporate seat in the end of September or by the end of September. And to be honest with you, Trent, you look at his experience, he's had various roles in a various number of different retailers. So you can't just look at upper scale men's apparel and say that, well, this isn't going to fit for a local retailer such as Big Lots, a retailer that says they are now a neighborhood market type retailer. However, if you look back, he actually ended up working at PetSmart for a good long while back in 2007. And to be honest with you, Trent, he comes in with a variety of experience, store operations, supply chain, etc. All of the areas in which Big Lots needs help in overall. I think Big Lots is sort of at this middle ground where they don't necessarily know how to get any more customers coming in through their doors because they're not necessarily an off-price retailer in some areas, yet they try to push out furniture. They try to, some quarters, push groceries and then retract from that strategy. So they do need good leadership. And I really hope, for Big Lots' sake, Bruce Thorne is the answer.
My looking ahead story has to do with Kroger. Late last week, they announced a phase-out plan for single-use plastic bags. The idea is that by 2025, Kroger will be done with single-use plastic bags. Now, 18 states, as of earlier this year, have some sort of plastic bag legislation where either they're not allowed in certain areas or certain cities, or there's an upcharge or an extra tax for using those plastic bags. The reason I'm looking ahead is not so much how Kroger is going to get this done. We're pretty sure that Rodney McMullen and crew will be able to pull that off, but how soon until other retailers follow suit? After all, Kroger and Walmart oftentimes are bellwethers in terms of social change, and so when we saw the likes of Kroger and Walmart make pledges towards cage-free eggs, for example, you saw a number of other retailers follow suit. So my looking ahead story, who's going to follow suit here, and what's going to happen to the plastic bag? Could it be eradicated potentially by, say, 2030, another icon in retail stores, perhaps eliminated simply because of the environmental impacts? And now, we're not arguing that it's a bad thing that it's being eliminated, certainly, if you look at certain environmental impacts of the plastic bags. But anytime something like this happens, the industry, the retail industry as a whole, moves surrounding this. And of course, the packaging industry will have to move surrounding this, and maybe those t-shirt bags will become more of a thing of the past. What's going to replace them? That's what I'm looking ahead, not only towards the next month, but also the next several years. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. A reminder, you can like us, rate us wherever you do find us. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Big thanks to My Emma for supporting us this week, as well as Products Up, and we will see you 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.